guys are listening to everything.
This is Tom Krautenmaker calling from Rolling Stone magazine. Can I speak to someone in Negative Land?
Always record episode 140.
Kind of production.
There are all sorts of possibilities.
You are listening. You are listening to Always Record, episode 140. Although this is the second part of a conversation with Mark Hosler of Negative Land, so you probably want to listen to the first part. That's 42 minutes, episode 206. Go listen to 42 minutes, 206, then come back here for part two, Always Record 140. Is that confusing?
Through the fields, only to be with you. Yep, with you. No one else, just you.
Here's the first top 40 hit.
140.
Yeah, that's really
okay. Andras is in the way. Wings, Mark, are you prepared? Do you have something to occupy you as far as drink and everything?
I have kissed honey lips.
Some melting ice cubes in a glass.
Felt my healing in her fingertips. I've even done that.
The letter you and the new one too.
I can walk you around my house.
You know, all the kissing on the honey lips. It burned like fire.
No, I'll treat this more like a library.
That's
how we began it as Alive. We noticed that there were occasions where, you know, crazy shit creep up. We had call-ins, and that was a disaster. So now we just do it. I'll count down.
Why are we doing it?
When I get to Alive, I start the time clock. He does the short intro, and then we go from there. And there's a little bit of play on whether you're still talking or whatnot when it gets close to 42 minutes, but we'll keep you updated on how much, not totally, but we'll control the conversation until it ends at 42.
140.
I'm calling time. And Mark, if you don't mind, maybe perhaps you can stay online. We can get a few more things out of the way if you guys want to continue talking. But that was 42 minutes. So Mark,
part one, 42 minutes.
Thank you so much. It's been a blast.
Sure.
And to everyone out there, you've been listening to Mark Hosler on 42 Minutes, a production of SyncBook Radio and TheSyncBook.com. To learn more about Negative Land, please visit NegativeLand.com. That's Negative Land with no second E. For more information about the SyncBook, our guests, to check out past shows and subscribe to the podcast via iTunes, please be sure and visit our website at thesyncbook.com. If you like this podcast and would like more, consider becoming a SyncBook Plus member. Some of the membership benefits include full access to complete audio archives, discounts on books, behind-the-scenes scripts, bonus audio and video, as well as monthly online hangouts with the host. All this and more can be found at thesyncbook.com/membership. Thanks so much, and I still haven't found what I'm looking for.
That's not me saying that, though. That's someone else.
All right, so let's pick that up. So, you know, actually, the video you watched, that was Andras wrote the script, and Will made the film to that.
Gotcha.
So this is your sort of creative team here. Scold them, correct them.
I'm not scolding anyone.
No, I know.
People get things wrong. Our story is so complicated. People get things wrong all the time. So I hope it didn't. I wasn't scolding you guys. I just was letting
scold
you know.
Them, spank them. Tell us we were wrong.
Those were somewhat significant errors, somewhat. And that's up to you. If you guys want to fix them or not, it's your show. You'll do whatever you want. But I did think that when I make my little video response, I actually thought in the video response, if you guys aren't going to fix those errors, I could mention it good-naturedly, of course.
That would be awesome.
I could mention it in the video. Just go, by the way, you know.
What are the mistakes? I want to hear them.
Oh, I emailed them. I sent them back to you guys.
I haven't seen that. They have. They told me about a few of them.
Negative Land is not from San Francisco. None of us have ever lived there. We're from the suburbs, a very different universe than San Francisco. It is not my brainchild. It is very much a collective thing that started with three of us in 79 and 80. And I am not the person doing the vocals on the U2 single. That's David Wills, the weatherman. That's not me. So those are the three things you got, which you confidently mentioned in your bit, but actually they're actually just factually incorrect. So,
and I just need to jump in here. When Alan said I wrote the script, Will did the research and gave me something that I turned into a script.
Pass
the buck. Now we're gonna.
I'm
man enough to take the blame. I don't give a shit. But I mean the overall purpose of the whole thing.
Well, you didn't do much. Your research was not much research. It wouldn't take much research to find out all three of those things if you read about it. So yeah, I say you fell down a little bit in the research department, young man.
Oh, yeah, and I did not.
This feels like scolding, just so we're all on the same book here.
Yeah, now I am scolding you. That's true.
sorry, Will, I didn't mean to.
Well, you know, if you're playing at being a media person in journalism. Yeah, you do got to do. You know, you must have. It seems to me like you must have read someone else's account. I wonder how you got in all three of those things. You had to have either made an assumption or you read someone else writing about us or something like that. So
I don't know. It was so long ago, and I'm pretty sure it probably happened on rewrites anyways. But
yes. And of course you're always free to actually ask someone in the group like me to and that's something here's what I end up doing. When I do interviews with interviews with the media, I always say to them, I say, hey, I'm not trying to write your article, but people get so many interesting facts about us completely incorrect. You're feel free to run your article past me. And if there's anything in there that you have factually wrong, I will let you know. And most of the time, I'd say about 70% of the time, the writers do. They actually send me the interview and give me a chance to kind of tweak it and put in the things that are just, just the facts.
Well, taking your advice, I'm going to go straight for the jugular. You've got to tell me the story on Give Me the Mermaid.
Well, what do you, which?
I want to know how that thing happened, because.
Audio? The video? It's
the video, especially, I think.
Because it didn't exist as video to start with. It existed as audio. It was an audio piece on the CD that came in our book about the lawsuit against us, the fair use, the story of the letter U in the numeral 2. So there's a CD in that book, and that's a track on there.
Well, see, what I'm interested in and what I like to do is changing the context by cutting up things or material. But I mean, you that happened with Gimme Mer. I can't listen to that. Look at this stuff. Isn't it neat?
Yeah, it's a great song.
Well, it totally is recontextualized when you put it in that context. Like, I can't think of it without seeing her as some kind of like media pirate or that song. That's what it does to my brain now.
That's great. I like hearing that. That's terrific.
But how did you guys do the animation? I heard some story that I'm trying to confirm that there was actually you had a plant in Walt Disney who helped you do that.
No, the guy who made it, well, it's not a plant. The guy who made it, who's now basically a part of our group, Tim Maloney, he worked for Walt Disney, and he knew how to draw Ariel. The animation of Ariel in that video is not appropriated. Tim drew that because he knew he worked for Disney, and that he knew how to draw her.
Oh, shit, that's wonderful. See, that's what I want. So it's not really like it's not cut from any of the animation used in the film.
No, it's not. And and the whole thing was made on Disney's computers on their dime. He rendered them on their computers like after hours. So, yeah, so that's kind of a fun part of the story, too. I mean, there's if you ever watch, what is it? We made a video to go with the track No Business. And No Business has appropriated footage mixed in with fake appropriated footage. You know, there's footage in there that looks completely stolen, and it's not. It's actually a set. It's actors, costumes. So, you know, it's fun to play with those things, you know, where people maybe don't always know, you know, what did you appropriate? What did you make? But in Give Me the Mermaid, he actually drew her, you know, the angry little mermaid. And in fact, it was Tim's idea to sync her up with the asshole music executive threatening to sue someone over the phone. He said, no, this will be a lot funnier if it's her saying this stuff. And
it is, too.
Yeah. But I love that video. That's one of my favorite little things that's come out of our whole collaborative process. And Tim, gradually just worked more and more and more with the group to at this point, you know, he's a pretty, you know, official member of the whole little family. And he was hugely involved in that archive of Over the Edge. Tim's the guy who spent, I mean, Over the Edge has been on since 81. And since the early 2000s, all the shows were recorded digitally and we had them and it was easy to kind of use those and put them online. But everything recorded before that, there were 20 years of shows that were all on cassette. And Tim spent 3 years transferring all those shows from analog to digital to make that archive. And that's just because he loves Don, loves the radio show, just wanted to see it happen. So he's, you know, an amazing, amazing thing that he did just out of the goodness of his heart.
To be annoyingly over-analytical, I wonder, is Over the Edge have anything to do with you getting one over on the edge?
Over the Edge started in 1981. So I think.
Well, I'm talking about Edge from U2, you tricking the shit out.
I know, but I'm just saying Over the Edge began in 1981. The record we made was in 1991. So okay. You could probably answer your question yourself.
It's just a coincidence.
Well, how could it be connected?
Right. Well, unless it's non-linearly connected.
Unless I live inside of a time, there's a time portal actually just next to my house, which has been part of how I know what's happening in 2022.
That is the part that goes back to what you were saying in the interview about we don't know where
inspiration.
I don't know where that's coming from. I'm just channeling it. And when someone says that to me, that feels feels like it is happening outside of, it happens in the same place that dreams and, you know, death happen, that it's not tethered to time. So I think Will, I mean, he's being a little bit obtuse about it, but because he's asking you in the sense of,
how dare you really call me obtuse?
Wait, that it literally inspired you, whereas from the standpoint, it might be interesting. I guess the question might be, during all of the time that you, in the 90s, when you were going through the stuff with U2, was there ever an awareness of the irony of getting one over on the edge? Actually poetically pointed out.
Obtuse, you know, like you might have thought about it for 10, somebody, I'm sure some of us thought about it for 5 seconds, maybe. Yeah. But I mean, no, the show's, you know, the show was on every week had already been on for 10 years when that happened. And in fact, gosh, had I even heard of, well, Don's the one, I'd say when Don started the show, he probably had never even heard of the group U2. That would be my guess.
Probably not. It would be more likely to be a reference to that early Matt Dillon film.
If it's anything, like it's a reference to if you listen to the Firesign Theater record in The Next World You're On Your Own, a wonderful record in The Next World You're On Your Own. There is a soap opera on that that you hear briefly that's called Over the Edge. And if Don took the name from anywhere, that would be it. But he's not here to ask him. But, you know, he just thought it was a nice name for his show. For the radio show, which didn't start out to be what it turned into. He just played one record after another like a normal DJ. And when we met him, we'd already put out our first album, and we were introduced to him by Ian Allen, another early member of the group who also died this year. So, you know, we've had a lot of shit going on. He just said, you guys got to meet each other because I think you're on the same wavelength. And Don was very open to us coming up to KPFA and bringing in all of our tape decks and synthesizers and mixers and devices and noisemakers and just putting us on the air. And we immediately started, you know, playing 3 records backwards at the same time and playing tape loops and putting phone calls on the air unscreened to do whatever they want. And Don suddenly saw, you know, oh my God, you could use the radio station itself as an instrument, you know, that radio, true actual radio art would be happening using the radio station to create it. And from then on, you know, he never wanted to go back. He was so excited and energized that was it. You know, he from then on wanted to just do this crazy live mix collage radio show. Little did any of us realize he would keep doing it for 34 years. Never paid, you know, he was always volunteer. And Negative Land, you know, did it a lot in those days, but as the years went by and we did it less, he was the mainstay. He had this great New England work ethic, and he just kept at it and kept at it and kept doing it. So it, for us, it's just a thrill, especially after him passing away. I mean, which we didn't. The timing is actually a strange coincidence that we had it all ready to go just before he died. So he knew it was. He knew. Days before he went into the hospital, Tim had actually told him, we're ready to go live. This huge part of your life's work is all going to go online. And he was very excited, very happy about it. So we're all really, it makes us feel good that, you know, he knew that. He knew that was going to happen. So that's kind of, that's been up there.
Can I, if no one minds, I just want to sort of rewind, and maybe if it's not put in the context of comparing you to Donald Trump, maybe we can get there a little
my
less abrasively. you were talking about the idea of when you said "Give Me the Mermaid," and you said, you know, we have the thing that we shot that was, it looks appropriated, but it's actually not.
That was in another video called No Business.
The Give Me the Mermaid was he's drawing it, he's redrawing it. It's not appropriated Ariel. It looks like it is. And then you're saying then there's something else in No Business that you've shot to look like it's appropriated. And then we have obviously Helter Stupid with this sort of, again, even though if you have the sort of disclaimer in the liner notes, the hoax to begin with, and I think what Will was trying to ask before, and I thought actually I'd really like to hear you speak to, again, and not comparing you to Donald Trump, but the idea of if you put some intentional confusion into the artwork.
Yes, and we always do. That's true.
And then, but then you also say like, and again, maybe these are two conversations, the same way that the fair use versus piracy is two different things. Maybe we can help me find this distinction. But so you say, you know, you encourage the journalists to get their information right. Maybe it's because if you're going to be a journalist, we require a certain standard of you. But at the same time, if you're sowing a certain amount of confusion in your work, does that not lead it to be misunderstood? Are you embracing being misunderstood? Or are you hoping that people...
No, yeah, not please. Embracing it. No, definitely not. But I think that I remember once I gave a talk in Winnipeg, and there was a lawyer who ended up, he was in the audience, and I spoke at length about the axe murder hoax thing, and I showed the news broadcast where we got on TV. And in the end, he was at a dinner the next day that I was at, and he was deeply offended by what we did, that we could take such a terrible human tragedy and exploit it and do all this stuff. And we had this strange conversation where it took me a while to finally realize, I finally dawned on me what was going on. And I said, do you make art at all or music? Are you creative? And he said, no. And I said, here's what I think you don't perhaps understand, is that when you make art, when you make music, when you do anything creative, you're asking questions. You're on a journey. You don't know where it's going to go. You know, that's part of what's interesting. And you have ideas, you adjust, you follow where it's going to take you. To some degree, you feel like a channel, as I said earlier. And I said, when we did this whole hoax, we didn't know it would blow up into this giant story, but it did. And so we sort of adjusted, well, where do we go with this now that this is happening? Same thing when we were sued. We did not expect to be sued for the U2 single, but we were. Well, what do we do with this now? Is this a problem? Maybe it's an opportunity. Maybe it's not a problem at all. Maybe it's an incredible opportunity. What do we do? So, again, so I hear where you're coming from in your questions and what you're getting at, but you're kind of presupposing a level of calculated intention that we don't have, because a lot of our work is asking questions, and the work is the result of the question, you know, which...
And just to be clear... You're presupposing that I'm presupposing, because I'm totally.
We're in a presupposing loop.
Yeah, I know. It's infinite recursion over here. I'm glad to hear that. I totally get you, because I think it's a, especially in a creative endeavor, it's constantly feeling torn. Why, one of the reasons I keep saying, well, I feel like trying to make these distinctions, it's constantly feeling out so much for the boundaries of just how does this feel? How does this feel? And I find myself sometimes getting upset when I'm misunderstood, or that I'm leaving a trail of breadcrumbs that someone's not following, or someone's half-assed paying attention, doing sloppy work. And then at the same time, I also know that I'm sowing some discord or confusion into it. And I'm like, so it's more I'm asking the question to you as I'm trying to find the answer for myself. So there's
okay,
no priest.
Okay. Gotcha.
Cool.
Well, yeah. I'll tell you, I remember when I was younger that when people got things wrong about our, misunderstood us, it bothered me. It really bothered me. And it took years to just let go and realize, look, when you make a work of art, it's like you're sending your little creation out into the world on its own. It does not come with an instruction manual, unless you could send it out with one. But it doesn't. You have to accept the fact that it's going to have a life of its own. And you don't know you don't know what's going to happen. And you can try and think about that to whatever degree you can when you create it. But, you know, I think that we were always aware that we tried to put a lot of information in our work. But you also know that in the end, people are going to be paying attention to varying degrees. You know, I mean, I meet people who know our work inside and out, every little detail. And I meet people who say they're big fans, but it turns out they listened in a very cursory way, or they've only heard the stuff that got the most media attention. And that's fine. There's, you know, all of those levels of enjoying our work are, you know, they're fine. They're great. But we certainly try in our work to – there's tons of levels of detail in our work, lots of conceptual stuff going on that if you do dig into it – we always designed our work over the years to be something that if you dug deeply into it, it would reward you. You'd find all kinds of interesting ways that projects intersect with other projects, you know, and they overlap and layer the conceptual aspects, the characters, the alternative universe stuff we've created. There's a ton of layers that are in the work, and the percentage of people who will notice all that is small. You know, we always know that. But that's sort of, yeah, that's all got to be, you know, okay. I think, though, that if I did work that was being misinterpreted constantly by most people, that would give me pause. I would worry that I was kind of fucking up, you know, like, oops. And maybe this kind of gets to your question. I think if enough people kind of get it enough, you know, 60-70% of the time, then I think, oh, that's fine. That's good. That's a good enough percentage for me. Cause people are always going to get things wrong. You know, that's going to happen.
I just think a lot about changing the perception of the consumer, and how to, in a very, you know, Mad Men type of way, how to get inside the audience's head and make them make certain decisions. And that's how I feel about the U2 album. You presented a piece of material that appeared to be something.
It wasn't.
That it wasn't.
Yeah.
And it fucking worked. It worked. It worked into the point where it got you into a lot of trouble. But I mean, with what you've done as far as, like, Give Me the Mermaid and No Business and everything, aren't you pushing buttons? Are you at least a little worried about ever getting sued again?
No, I'm actually not worried at all about being sued again. I think that weirdly enough, I think that we caused such a shitstorm of bad press for U2 after we were sued that I think that, I mean, I've met people in the mainstream music industry and they all say, oh, yeah, we know who you guys are. And no, we're never going to sue you because why would we? There's no money to be had and you would just turn it into a conceptual art project and make us look bad.
Right. But that's one of the reasons I was talking about the TPP. And like now we have a fucking robotic censor where we don't get sued. You just get locked down. Like I actually uploaded something to YouTube.
Yeah.
Oh, this is funny. Yeah. YouTube. I uploaded something to YouTube, the video website, I don't know, a few weeks ago, where I'm talking about you and your involvement with Radio 8 Ball and whatever, and I use some clips from some shit. Guess what? That thing where I'm talking about fair use, I'm talking about negative land, I'm talking about whatever, YouTube blocked it. Like as soon as it finished uploading, boom, you're hit for copyright. Couldn't contend with it. I tried re-rendering.
But now this is a pain in the ass, but right. I know the lawyer. I have met with the lawyers at YouTube And they actually do know about fair use quite well, and they're very pro fair use. They're surprisingly progressive, but they are playing ball with the big boys. So even though it's a huge pain in your ass, I hate it. But if you had, I've actually talked to someone just on this little solo tour, a guy that did the same thing. He actually uploaded a video to do at Negative Land, and it got taken down. And it was part of it using a lecture I was giving. It was actually partly a lecture I was giving on our U2 single. And I used, and it got taken down. And he wrote to YouTube, and he just said, you need to let this go back up because this is not only a fair use, but it's actually a lecture about fair use. I mean, it's literally about this and using this as an example. And YouTube turned around and they let it go up. So they're not. It's awfully difficult that you would have to write that letter. But I would say that if you had written them, I think the chances are very good that they would have gotten back to you and they would have let it go on. But that being said, the whole idea that there's these bots that have no human being behind them, right, that is just literally scanning, yes, that is completely creepy and scary science fiction. You know, it's fucked up. It's definitely a weird, weird, weird thing. But you can contest it, and they're quite liberal, really, about all you got to do is write one little letter, and they would almost certainly – what I've always heard is that they'll let it go.
What was hilarious is
until the TPP,
right?
Well, I don't know how all that's going to be implemented, and that whole thing is very strange because that is, as I said, that is like they're getting their wet dream for how to control the internet more. Yeah, I don't know.
What was hilarious about that is the copyright claim came from Viacom because there's a TV show on Comedy Central. So my friend Joe, who have some people are up downloading his videos, re-uploading them, a Comedy Central TV show played clips of his YouTube video, which, by the way, is using some copyrighted footage. So it's all like passing the buck. They were able to show it on TV probably without paying the original rights because they're claiming that this is the property of YouTube. YouTube user. Now, they didn't pay my friend. They didn't anything. They're playing his clip, but now he's using somebody else's footage, and it's all this sort of shell game, but they put it on their fucking TV show. I then take a clip from their TV show and go to comment on it, put it on YouTube, and then Viacom steps in and says, I've taken a clip from their TV show, which is a TV show commenting on my friend's video, which is commenting on another piece of media,
right,
et cetera,
but
et cetera, et cetera.
Right, but you realize it isn't, and then that is a great circular snake-eating-its-tail ridiculous insanity and a good example of how stupid this is. But Viacom, I would almost guarantee you, no living human being made that decision. That was just a program. And I actually, one of the things I did ask some, I asked one of the lawyers at YouTube, and I said, look, the only way you guys can do an A-B comparison to see whether or not someone's video had a 5-second clip of a Harry Potter movie in it, have the movie and has the entire entertainment industry given you digital copies of everything that they own? And they said, yes, they have. They have terabytes and terabytes of every Hollywood movie ever made and every corporate rock record ever made, and that's how they're able to do the A-B and within seconds pull your, you know,
right,
your clip down.
We have to get creative on how to, because we know we're dealing with bots, so we speed up clips or we add filters to clips or we put picture in picture so that they don't recognize what we're actually using.
Sure.
But it's a jungle gym.
Well, some point I would urge you, even though, as I said, it's a total pain in the ass, but if you wrote the story you just told me about how it's your friend's video, which the TV show used without permission, you know, the whole thing, you could explain that entire story in a letter to YouTube and say, and this is why I was using this to then comment on this on my page. So would you please allow this to go back up? This seems to me to be, you know, fair use. I would urge you to write that letter, even though it'll probably take you.
Well, I've disputed. Me in particular have disputed. I've disputed shit. I've actually won, but the bots are still on it. Like, even though you get it back up, a month or 2 months later, the bots have hit it again, and then you have to read it. So it's never ending. Like, I'll get notifications all the time, and then I have, like, a little cut-and-paste thing. This is within the free use. It's only using a fraction. It's to educate and...
Oh, okay. All right. Good for you.
Yeah, but it just – it's a never-ending battle. I mean, that's what most
well,
of
go,
us have...
But then go to – but then we're, you know, I mean, I have mixed – I hear everything you're saying, and I'm glad that your stories are good to hear. And yet I also think, well, I mean, do we have a right to just go and – YouTube is a privately owned for-profit business. So if they decide to police it in however they want, I mean, in some ways, could the argument be made that that's their prerogative? You know, it's their business.
Well, absolutely. So then is the next step, you know, but as someone who's been working at this a long time, you know, when you
go
say –
go to Vimeo. Vimeo won't nail you, but they don't have – this. The thing that's great about
right.
YouTube is that because it's so big, there's all the traffic and eyeballs and stuff. People just run across it with interesting search terms. That's what's wonderful about it. But when we made a trailer for It's All in Your Head, that used – some music in it by Vangelis, and that thing we posted that, and YouTube took that down in 5 seconds, and so we ended up we just didn't want to bother, and we ended up posting it to Vimeo, you know, and
by
that's
any
how we
chance
shared it.
Is oh, you talking about the people who did the soundtrack to Blade Runner?
Vangelis is one guy, and it was an album of his called Heaven and Hell, and the Over the Edge radio show theme that's used every week. From 81 up until Don's death was from that album. Yes, by Vangelis. So It's All in Your Head used that music in it a little bit. And
okay.
But, you know, we weren't – it was kind of – for us, it was like, well, we'll just use Vimeo and it's fine because we're just sending this out to fans and journalists and people on our Facebook page. And enough people will see it. It's okay. You know, it'll work.
Have you noticed – this is another thing. I have videos of the Radio 8 Ball show that we filmed that I filmed in a theater with a guest and a musician who's there who's not – like playing their own music. And it plays fine here in the United States. But if I want someone – if I have a friend in Bali, it's blocked for them as if it was – I also do something where a lot of us do sync films where we sync up an album with a film and let it run.
Yeah.
And I have one with The Matrix and The Who's Lifehouse.
Well, there
you
go.
That has stuff in the United States, but it says, it tells me on YouTube, this is the viewership for this is limited. I'm figuring because their licenses are limited.
Yeah.
But to see an original video of mine on Vimeo that a friend of mine who's in Bali can't watch, it makes me wonder. I just make
Vimeo
me wonder
or YouTube?
Whole...
Did you have this problem?
Vimeo.
Oh, okay.
This
right.
A Vimeo video
yeah.
that they were not able to watch in Bali.
Interesting.
And it makes me wonder how much we're – like you hear about like other countries and how they're on – their internet is on lockdown in different ways. Like they, and it makes me wonder how much ours is.
Yeah,
like even our not fair use stuff.
Yeah.
Are people allowed to watch stuff from the United States? How many other that's something I'd be and maybe you don't know about that, but I'm
No, I don't.
Something I would be curious about
is
how does this play out beyond our borders?
Yeah. Well, I have never heard anything from our own, you know, there's a bunch of our videos which are up on YouTube. And a lot of them use appropriated stuff, and they haven't been flagged. But I think, that's pretty interesting that it would be another country like that. What would be the agreement? But there's some agreement. There's some weird agreements that are being made with these different film studios of territories and stuff. So.
Yeah, it's a brave new world.
Oh, it is. It's very, very strange because we're all debating about – I think what makes it so completely nuts is that, as I think we were sort of – an argument we were making earlier on was if a car – you know, if you steal someone's car, they don't have their car anymore, right? They can't drive it. But if a car drives past your house and you have a device that's a car copier and you point it at the car driving past your house and you make a copy and you make a copy of a bunch of cars that drive past your house, and you glue them all together into some weird hybrid collage version of a car that you think is cool looking, why does the owner of the cars that drove past you give a shit, right?
Right.
But they do, you know, so we're passing laws. We're going to be, you know, making it, we're going to be, you know, with TPP probably making it a felony to deal with these things that are ones and zeros that kind of don't exist, you know. They're not real, in the same way that a book is real, or your car is real, you know, your house is real.
Well, it's funny because I got into an argument once, and again, I sort of took it as a mental exercise, but I actually got into an argument with a guy who claimed to be a libertarian, not even an anarchist, but I would find myself in that same territory, but like intellectually or conceptually, but he was arguing so far against intellectual property law that he said, if I wrote a book and he took that book and typed it up sentence for sentence or scanned it in or whatever and then put his name on it, he should be able to do that. And then in the marketplace of ideas, his book or my book should be – and I'm like, no, fuck you. Like, that seems wrong. Like, I put in the work.
Well, he just sounds like a dope.
Well, right.
How old is he? Is he like 22? I mean, what?
This conversation was a few years ago. He was probably in his late 20s.
Okay.
Mid to late 20s.
That's just kind of a bit dopey.
Right.
So, but there are bigger, you know, there's bigger questions about, I mean, we're invested, we're embedded and invested in this capitalist system as if this is the only way that human beings can exist and do things. And of course, that's not true, you know. There's all kinds of layers and layers to this kind of stuff about, you know, what could be. I mean, what's an example I think of is when a farmer, okay, let's say you have an apple, you're a farmer, you have an apple orchard, right? When you sell your apples to someone, the transaction's over. You do not come into their house a week later and say, hey, that apple pie you made with my apples that you bought for me,
right.
I've been a piece of that.
Ooh, or right, and if he plants the seeds inside the apple and grows his own tree.
You took some seeds out of those apples you bought for me and you grew an apple tree in your yard. I'm taking that. And
10%.
that's what we're doing, right? It's kind of arbitrary. My understanding in the fashion world is that it's sort of been understood that when you debut your new lines of fashions, that everything gets stolen by everybody. It just kind of is the nature of it. You know, it's part of the kind of the culture, both creatively and from a business standpoint. And
what do you think about William S. Burroughs?
Well, in relation to what?
Cut-ups. He has this famous quote of saying, you know, as far as like writing books and everything, steal everything that's not nailed down.
Well, like, he's also given to hyperbole, and you know, he's an interesting character. So I got to do a presentation at his 100th birthday event that was in almost a year ago. He did some interesting stuff at the time, innovative. I think you know, he'd take text and cut it all up and rearrange it at random to write his books. Or he'd write his own text. He'd take his own text that he wrote and he would cut up his own text and then structure, which I think is more interesting, you know. It was ways to restructure stuff he had generated himself in some sort of way.
But what is that? One of the favorite, there's an interview with him where somebody's like, well, don't you think you should use your own words? And he goes, well, what words do I have? It's basically the idea that everything that we know as intellect is borrowed from, you know, something else or some cliche that we heard or some thing.
Ooh,
that we heard.
Do you guys remember a few years ago, Donald Trump, when he was doing that TV show, he tried to copyright the term "you're fired"? He wanted to copyright that phrase?
Probably trademark it.
Which
is different, by the way, but go ahead.
Please continue to correct me, but the idea when you say the idea of owning the words, like my mind is picturing this just fucking dystopian future where, right, where like the language is owned that you're, you know, it's
But
even conceptually, it doesn't have to be this cartoon world. Conceptually, yes, we are constantly, I'm speaking to you right now with words that are not my own, that are not of my own creation. I'm structuring them. Only thing I can do is create a collage using found media, essentially, found words.
Yeah, are you asking a question?
Oh, sort of just flights of fancy, but please tell me what.
Well, I think that part of what we're, this kind of goes to something I was saying in the interview, which is that it's just, we're witnessing the inexorable, horrific logic that everything should be privatized and owned, that nothing has any value unless you can make money off it, right? And it ultimately, I think that there's an interesting middle ground with that, where maybe it leads to innovation and interesting stuff, but ultimately it becomes it's a death sentence, you know, in all possible ways. You know, if you follow anything to do with what's happening with acidification of the ocean, the methane that's going to be in the permafrost melting, climate change and all that, you know, we have a system that's completely unsustainable. You know, we are living and operating as if somehow there's endless amounts of energy, if there's endless numbers of endless amounts of topsoil on the planet, and, you know, as the saying goes, there is no planet B, you know, this is it, but we operate as if there is. It's the privatization of absolutely everything. I think that's what Negativeland bumped into in our own small way, was, wow, these corporations want to tell us that all we can do is consume this culture and mass media around me and don't ever do anything with it. But you're putting it in my fucking face and my brain space, whether I want it or not. I don't like seeing billboards everywhere. They're ugly. You know, they just mar the landscape, for crying out loud. If you've ever been to Hawaii or Santa Fe or Vermont where there's no billboards, or I was years ago when I was in Melbourne, Australia, there's very few. It's a relief. It's really nice, you know. But anyway, they're everywhere. This media is everywhere. Ads are everywhere. And here I was, my friends and I were just kind of intuitively at first, because we were just kids, we were just taking it all in and saying, oh, yeah, we're going to make stuff out of that, because that's just that's what we're immersed in. We're swimming in it. You know, and these guys are now, these yahoos are going to tell me that I can't. I'm just only supposed to buy your Little Mermaid videos, but don't actually do anything with it, or don't redraw her to do what you want her to do. I think it can be interesting. I don't know about nowadays, because so many people, but certainly there was this period of time, it seemed like in the 80s, where it really shocked people that you could have the nerve to take something that wasn't yours and reuse it to make some new thing. It was actually startling, and it seemed transgressive to people, and gave them a different perspective on things. Maybe it's empowered them, you know, gave them permission. Like, wow, you guys could just stole all that stuff to make this? Oh my God, I didn't know you could do that. That's great.
In the 90s, there was this a trend of wearing shirts that looked like corporate logos but said something different, you know, like Taco Bell, Toca Bowl, or something like that. But
those were cute.
I think I kind of feel like you kind of helped push that there. Whether, you know, the collective conscious was aware of Negativeland,
sure,
it's kind of like laid it down until that happened. It was like
But that's part of why it was exciting to do, because, you know, there's that Groucho Marx saying, you know, I would never want to be in a club that would have me as a member. And that certainly describes me really well. And part of what excited us about some of the things we did in Negativeland was the sense that we weren't supposed to be. We wanted to do it exactly because it seemed like, you're not really supposed to be doing this, are you? That is owned by someone, you know. You really shouldn't make a record that looks like a new record by this giant corporate internationally famous band. But that's an interesting idea. And also, just going back to your question, which may or may not, I may be misinterpreting you, but, you know, the cover art for the U2 single was one of the last things that we came up with. You know, we didn't go into it, but that wasn't the reason we made it. You know, there was a lot of reasons why we made that record. That's part of why we loved the project. But the initial thing that inspired it was just getting the tapes of Casey Kasem going off the handle. You know, we got those, and that inspired us to make something. And in fact, because Andras will know him, I think. You know, you remember Randall Hunting?
Yeah.
Well, Randall is the guy. Randall is the one I was designing that cover with in Olympia, and we were sitting up in his apartment upstairs. He lived upstairs, house on 4th Ave. It's where Bob Bassinich lived with Amy Moon for a little while.
Was it at the Martin?
No, it was on the, I think it's 4th, right as you first come in, right across the street from kind of that apartment upstairs from.
In the brick one on the corner.
It's really close, right as you come in from the west side. It's right there. And yeah, upstairs. I don't know what's downstairs now. I can't remember if it's a florist or I can't remember. But Randall was the one. We were working on the cover. He was the one that was, he was messing around with his computer, and he said, well, look at this. What if we made the U2 really big and Negative Ed really small? He actually suggested it's his fault. And he suggested it. We've publicly credited him for this, you know, because he deserves the credit. And he said, and I remember looking at it going, oh my God, that's fantastic. And boy, we're not supposed to do that, but that is great. You know, we got it. That is a great idea. Yes. Let me show that to the rest of the group and see what they think. And everyone just gave it the thumbs up, you know, like that is an excellent idea. And so it created this moment of confusion in the marketplace where people didn't know what it was, or the record store guy who was putting it out on display didn't know what it was. You know, Tower Records made an entire window display thinking it was the new single from U2's new album coming out. They hadn't listened to it yet. So. Yes, and that was supposed to cause confusion. That's true. But we hoped that eventually people would also figure it out. And I like having my brain played with. You know, I love seeing a movie where you think you know what the story is and halfway through the rug is pulled out from underneath you, you know, some reveal that just everything you thought was happening isn't what it was at all. You know, that can be quite delightful, you know, to experience that in a work of art, I think.
Well, to clarify, like I said, it was a comment that you made in one of your lectures. I can't remember which one or whatever, but you used the phrase like causing confusion at the point of consumption that really has stuck in my head. Like what?
Yeah.
It's like a public relations tactic of making it appear like something and right at it, like an impulse buy type of thing where you put the object right next to the cash register and
yeah, but it wasn't to sell. It wasn't to manipulate people into buying it. It was just an interesting thing to do. We did a record in 93 called Free. And the idea was instead of putting the title Free in the print, we made a fluorescent orange, a fluorescent green sticker die cut that went over the packaging that said Free. And the idea was that we thought it would look like you can just take this from the record store because it's free. Just go ahead, just take it, steal it, you know, walk out of there because it's free. And did anyone do that? I don't know. But that was the idea, and it certainly made it annoying to record store owners.
Well, hey, you know. There's two names, two artists whose names you see, particular pieces of work that just keep coming up throughout this conversation for me. One is Abby Hoffman. Just when you said that, I thought of Abby Hoffman and Steal This Book.
Yes.
Which is a very similar, beautiful, like, culture jammy idea.
Yes.
And then the other one is about, I'm just curious if you've heard about this, that the, you know, the War of the Worlds factor, when you were talking about Helter Stupid, you know, that if you hear it out of context, it can lead to all kind of unforeseen misinterpretations of the work. But what's interesting, and I heard this news story, is that every time someone there's a few places where they've redone the experiment. They've just done the War of the Worlds broadcast as written with new actors set to the place where they are, you know, set to real time.
Right.
As the first one was. And in each time, it has caused a similar level of madness to like communal
sure.
madness to what happened in New Jersey when the original broadcast happened.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious about about both of those artists and how, you know, if there's a sense of particularly those particular works in influencing your work or being, you know, being foundational or just curious, mostly just kind of curious to hear your take on them.
Well, Don loved War of the Worlds and loved, we all love Orson Welles, of course. We all love Citizen Kane. And certainly War of the Worlds and what happened with it, you know, is certainly a great story. But I also think War of the Worlds was trying to simply be an entertainment. It wasn't talking about our culture. It wasn't critiquing. It wasn't about anything real in that way. It was taking this. It was an update on H.G. Wells' novel. The radio broadcast was, and I think that for us, you know, there's the sense in appropriating media and reusing it. You know, you are doing something that is in some way or another, however oddball, snarky, funny, goofy, weird it is critiquing and talking about our culture. And it is doing it in a way that's legally a problem, you know, in a very gray area, or some would even say illegal area. So I think it sort of gives it a pretty different feel for us than the idea of just doing kind of a fun radio broadcast that might happen to, you know, confuse some people.
Well, but like with Citizen Kane, like say that stands on, that's Orson Welles trying to do it in another way. And in that case, he definitely is. He's totally culture jamming, media magnate. It's not Howard Hughes. William Randolph Hearst. And completely, you know, using his friends and his information and using the machinery of making a movie and also playing with the newsreel footage. And
well, yeah,
it's,
but it's
a similar sense of being authentic and then trying to.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying it's the same thing,
yeah.
But do you see the other part that I kept thinking of was National Lampoon in the 1970s, where they were constantly trying to exactly replicate the thing that they were making fun of aesthetically.
Yeah. Well, we didn't. I mean, the one time, you know, we've been around 35 years and we've put out 30 records. So the one time we did that was there is one example where we did that, and I'm very proud of it. And I would never do it. If I had to redo it, I would do everything exactly the way we did it. You know, but hell, for me, I'd say for me personally, you know, what influenced me as a kid more in that kind of speaking truth to power and mocking authority was I read Mad Magazine religiously. You know,
not surprised by that.
Yeah, Mad Magazine was a great, you know, growing up in the suburbs, not being exposed to much any alternative culture. The attitude of that was that nothing, you know, Mad Magazine mocked all things in media, all things political. It also mocked you, the reader, and it mocked themselves, the people who made the magazine for you. They made fun of everything. And I really think that absolutely, I loved that. And that absolutely, I'm sure that had a huge impact on me. But that's my age, you know, because I'm sure I'm a little older than you guys.
Yeah, I'm only 37. You've been making music for about as long as I've been alive.
Yeah, I'm 53. So, yeah, it's a different thing. National Lampoon, I was aware of and looked at, but actually a lot of times I didn't think they were that funny, actually. I thought a lot of times that the humor kind of was a misfire. I mean, these days, I mean, The Onion is oftentimes absolutely genius, brilliant.
Yeah.
You know, fantastic. So,
Alan, how are we looking?
Oh, I'm.
I think
here.
Andras just vanished. By the way.
Oh, is that true? Let's see.
Yes,
did he drop?
Yeah, maybe that's perfect serendipity. I really gotta go, but I didn't want to end this. I've been enjoying this so much.
Well, if you ever have practical, you know, questions about copyright or fair use or whatever, you know, feel free to. You know, because I have learned a lot over the years, but it's kind of good that I think it went our conversation, that conflating of the different things, that happens a lot, that people do that a lot. And it took me a while to realize, oh, they're actually two separate conversations, and I can have both conversations, but they're different.
They are separate, exactly.
Yeah, they're different. You know, do I care that the pirating of music has led to the destruction, the gradual destruction of the mainstream music industry? No, who cares? Yay! You know, who gives a shit? You know, I cry no crocodile tears for those guys because they're just, it's awful business. But how has it impacted the ability of individuals to survive and thrive? You know, well, yeah, it's pretty weird, you know, and
we're fucked. We sort of took their ship down, but went down with it.
Maybe, you know, but I also kind of keep thinking, well, if you're, I mean, negative land, this is kind of a, I don't know if this will be interesting to you or not, but basically Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band is the first record that I can really point to that's a studio-made record. The group has stopped touring. The Beatles never tour ever again. They're done. And they utilized the studio to create something you could never perform live, certainly back then. You could simply never do it. And it's the first time they do that. And then Brian Eno comes along, you know, how many years later? Six, and he makes a career out of it where he's not playing, you know, he briefly plays live with Roxy Music, but Brian Eno, who I'm sure you know I'm going to guess you know who that is.
Yeah.
He has this really successful career where he makes he's just only a studio guy. And we have this whole era of musicians who can do that. Negative Land comes of age a little later. You know, we're listening to all these people and we start doing stuff in 78, 79, and we're kind of a bit of both. You know, mostly we make studio records, and that's where any income we get comes from. But we do play live sometimes, but never a lot. We would go years without touring. It was never a big part of what we do. So now we're entering into a world where clearly there is some money to be made out there to survive. If you want to survive and thrive as an artist or a musician, and you want to tour a lot, if you're willing to do it, and you have a show that people like, that can work as a model. You know, that can work pretty – that can work. But Negative Land's a bit caught because we're older and it's not something that nobody wants to go spend the next year of their life touring. You know, we'll go out for a few weeks at a time maybe, but that's kind of about all anyone's willing to do. And so I thought due to changing times, the economics, the cultural, what is it? Like the economics of the technological shifts and how they impact culture, it means I could say, oh yeah, we're kind of caught in the middle here. We're a little bit screwed. Whereas if we were younger, maybe we would be adapting better, you know? I don't know. Mm. I mean, I just played 3 solo shows, and I actually, you know, I did okay. I made a little money at each show at the door, enough, and then I sold merchandise. And actually, interestingly enough, the thing that people are buying is our new record that comes inside of a Bible. They want the Bible, the thing it comes in. They love the packaging so much that they want it. You know, and nice. I came home with enough money to pay my bills for maybe a couple of months.
So when you're playing Negative Land material when you're soloing?
No. No, not at all. Negative Land doesn't play Negative Land material when we play live either. No, we never have. Negative Land, since the very first show we ever played in 1980, we've always done stuff live that is just uniquely created for live performance. And maybe 5% of our show might be stuff that's from our records, but the rest of it's all original. We've always
done
that. So
when you go solo, is it a set list or are you just kind of
spontaneous? It's solo is 100% improvised. Negative Land Live is a set, and we have a live visual video guy. It's all it's very figured out, but within that structure, there's a lot of room to do it different every night. We leave a lot of wiggle room where each piece we do could be done very differently from night to night, but we know we're going to move through this set. You know, we know what the encore is going to be if we get asked to do one. But when I play solo, part of what's been interesting for me to do is I'm improvising the whole thing from beginning to end. And the structure, the form, I improvise pieces. I actually improvise little 3 to 5 minute pieces. And I do, I'll do like 10 or 12 of them in a night. And it sounds like I'm doing it sounds like a set, but it's actually completely made up. And I've done like about 45 of those maybe, I think. Solo in the last few years.
Wow.
Are they being recorded or no?
Sometimes, but I'm doing them in quadraphonic sound. So the sounds, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
You can't really record. Right. Or even if you could record them on a digital multitrack, how would you play it back?
Right.
So, and in a way, I like that. I actually, there is video up of, you can find video of me doing it, but I kind of like the fact that I'm creating this thing live that absolutely can only happen in that moment in that room if you're there with me. You can't really translate it. And I actually think that's kind of cool. I like the ephemeral nature of it. You know, it seems true to the medium. I've never really been that keen on, hey, we recorded this album in the studio, and then we just go on stage and play it exactly the same, you know? Eh, that's just so, that just feels soul deadening to me.
Mark, I find you incredibly inspiring and insightful, and I appreciate the conversation that we've had. Yeah. I don't want to gush or anything, but you're a hero. So I want to extend the respect to you in saying that we've had the recorder going the whole time.
Oh, my God!
And and make sure that it's okay to use any of that material for another podcast besides 42 Minutes.
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
Awesome.
I wouldn't say anything that I wouldn't, I don't think I'd say anything that I wouldn't be saying. You know, I don't know you guys, so I'm just saying what I'm saying to you guys as strangers, but but it's been fun. It's been a fun conversation, really interesting. And I like that you were, what interests me the most is when I've gotten to do interviews or when I do lectures, I love the Q&A the most, because when someone asks me a question that actually is a hard question or tricky one, that's when I'm actually really trying to work it out and my brain's working, and that's the most fun to me. I think what Negative Land Hopes Our Work does is I don't know where it goes with people who experience it, but I hope it gets people's brains working. In whatever way that plays out, I don't know. But just that you're engaged. The reason why there's some aspect, element of confusion in our work obviously has a great deal of intention and thinking put into it. But there's also an element of confusion put in intentionally, because I think that's where the listener is engaging with you. You know, if you spell it out exactly, perfectly, I think the listener may shut off, you know. But if you have some aspect to it that's inviting, they're trying to work out just exactly what are you guys up to here. You know, I think that's when you've got someone, they're really engaged with your work. And that's, to me, that's exciting. You know, that's a real exciting way to make art.
To illustrate a wedge between you and Donald Trump, I think that personally Donald Trump, he does the opposite. He tries to shut down people's thinking. And he causes confusion in his audience, but I saw one thing where he was down in Alabama giving some kind of
people stupid, which is a very interesting thing for a politician to do, or so-called politician. I don't know what he is.
He's placating to what people want to hear. There's a big push for, you know, not being politically correct, so he specifically does that. But, you know, he Bible thumps in this weird way. It's like, come on, people. Like, Donald Trump gives three shits about the Bible, guaranteed. But he'll sit there and say, oh, that's my first favorite book. My second favorite book, of course, is my own, and stuff like that. And people cheer, and it's a total... he's totally just placating to a consumer who's buying a certain product and using the symbol of the Bible in a way you did too, but to appeal to a certain crowd for votes.
Oh yeah, he's a what's interesting about him is that he does this, I think, instinctively. He just happens to be this weird creature that can just do that, right? I think he just kind of reads the moment, he reads the crowd, and he's able to kind of just spout out this shit that plays very well to a certain kind of... I mean, one of the things I think about the Tea Party and that whole kind of person that Trump is speaking to, those people are mad. They're pissed off. And you know what? You're right to be pissed off. I think those people have a kind of an inarticulate... I don't think they're all that intellectual. You know, that sounds awful to say, but they're pissed because they just feel like the system is screwing them. And you know what? It is screwing you. You are being fucked hard by our system. But the problem is you're being faked out by the Trumps, the Carsons, the Fox News. They're pointing you to the wrong, you know, they're misleading you, you know, into who the enemy, you know, who you should be fighting. I always feel like those people are just one small insight away from becoming some radical leftist. But it's so they're angry at, I mean, they voted in. The other thing is they voted in a lot of these Tea Party, a lot of these reactionary, all the people who've been obstructing everything Obama wanted to do just because it was Obama, not because they actually were against it. Right. We've seen that now for years. Those people got into office. They're doing that, but they didn't change anything. And so I think all these people, the people who are drawn to someone like Trump, they're just mad. And so they just want someone who isn't those people. They just want anyone who's a real outsider who isn't these other things. And that's part of the way those two guys in particular precisely because they aren't politicians. They don't have any political background, which in fact makes them completely terrifying to imagine someone with their finger on the button. But that's the draw. That's the appeal.
You're tempting me with a conversation of politics when
we're trying to get off the phone.
I know, but. You know, would you not – would you agree – so you said about Hillary Clinton, you know, admitting full well that she would bomb the shit out of anyone first chance she gets. Would you not say that Obama in one way was the same thing? If people were pissed at George Bush and rightfully so. George Bush was a steaming pile of fascist bullshit. But he – by saying we need something else, we need the opposite of that, you bring in this guy who – we give him a Nobel Peace Prize and the remote control to a million fucking drones and he goes around the world blowing shit up. So at what point do we say, you know, we're continually being fooled. We're continually looking for the thing that's going to be
The system we're embedded in simply – it's not – you know, we live in a democratic republic, not a democracy, and it's not even that. It's an oligarchy, and that's just obvious. That's not even a point of just – you know, that's just a fact in my view.
Yeah.
It's not an opinion. It's a fucking oligarchy and a plutocracy. And that – so the system is so rigged, going back to the psychopaths and the sociopaths, that – I remember all my friends who were enthusiastic, so enthusiastic about Obama. And I said, look, I'm going to vote for him too. But believe me, the powers that be are not letting this guy get this high up into running for office that he hasn't been vetted and he's okay. He's not going to rock the boat with Wall Street or the Pentagon, the basic behind the scenes stuff where it really matters. He's going to play ball with those people. Trust me, you're going to not be happy with what he does in office. And people didn't believe me. And, I voted for him and I was glad. I mean, he certainly talked a good game. He's very telegenic. He seems like an introspective, thoughtful guy. I don't know if he really is, but he sure comes across as one, but you can certainly, as it sounds like you're aware, if you look at his actual policies, there's many areas where he is as bad or worse than Bush, you know, many, many areas. And all of my Obama loving friends hate to hear that. They just don't even want to think about it, you know, because they just want to believe in him. But we have a system that is just, you know, it cannot work. It is we are a civilization in decline. And if you look historically at all civilizations as they collapse, we're doing everything that they do. We're doing everything Rome did to a T. You know, we're doing it. And so what do we do as individuals? You know, I don't know. You know, we all do what we can, where we can. You know, I'm doing what I can with my creativity. You're doing what you can in your lives, I'm sure, with your friends and loved ones and also this podcast. You know, you do what you can. But clearly America is going down. I mean, there's no question. You know, it's just are we taking the whole planet with us? You know, that's the problem. You know, if it was in ancient times, we could just say, well, sure, the civilization's going, but the whole world isn't going to end.
Yeah.
But now we're looking at, well, you know what? Actually, maybe in 100 years, we're just going to have small numbers of bloodthirsty people, you know, fighting over the remaining tin cans of beans of the North and South Pole with their piles of guns. And it'll only be the people who are willing to kill everyone else to get there. You know, that's what's going to happen. You know, that's what I'm afraid of. So. Yeah.
Well, we still have hours and hours of, you know, negative land tapes to listen to as they sit amongst their cans of beans and radioactive spam. Hey.
Well, if the servers are still up and running, yeah. So, I mean. Yeah, I mean, these are all these existentially bizarre conundrums. I happen to be, I mean, I lived in Olympia out on Cooper Point Peninsula and in a beautiful location. I lived near the water. I had a canoe. I now live up a dirt road in the middle of rural Appalachia. I'm very lucky. You know, I live very frugally. I'm well below poverty level income, but I feel at times like I live like I'm a millionaire, you know, because my quality of life, I have been able to carve out a little tiny speck of the universe where my, you know, I'm sitting talking to you where my view is I'm looking out my picture window of my living room at the Appalachian Mountains, you know, and I never lock my doors and there's no street lights out here. And, you know, it's really lovely. And I know this isn't the real world, you know.
Yeah. Well, but when I lived in Asheville, my feeling there was that if the shit ever hit the fan sort of, you know, worst case scenario, it was like, this place would totally be sustainable. Like you could, there's people growing food and there's a, you know, the landscape and the, and nature was on your side and enough of a sort of intentionality.
I hear you, but I think you're wrong because I think that how would you, have you been here? You've been here through a winter. You know how cold it gets?
Sure.
I mean,
yeah.
We'd have to be cutting down with enough sharpened axes if we didn't have the gasoline to run chainsaw. I mean, would we have enough fuel to, I've pondered this a little bit. I'm not a survivalist kind of person, but it has occurred to me, like, how would this work, you know? And I think that I have a wood stove and I don't know, I it could last for a little while, but I think it would, I don't know how long it would really work for, but you know,
sure,
it would get pretty brutal. I really think that we are, you know, to use a cliche, everything's connected, we're all interconnected. And so when you there's nowhere to hide, you know, there's nowhere. I think the whole survivalist mentality I always thought was kind of goofball, because I thought, look, if you're the one person that has enough canned foods and solar panels and guns to protect yourself, I mean, what do you think, you know, how long does that last for? It will run out eventually. The solar panels will eventually need to be replaced. You'll eventually run out of cans of beans. You'll run out of bullets, you know, unless you can work with others and cooperate and with other human beings. I don't see how that, I don't see how it works.
Right. Can you live long enough for the radiation or the ocean to recede or whatever? There was a time, but right, as the cataclysm gets bigger and bigger. Well, we went into a very interesting.
On that note, right. You guys,
on that positive note, I'm looking forward to everyone from Florida moving up into these mountains because the entire coastline is underwater. Well, you've seen, you know what? Look at what happened in Manhattan just a few years ago. It was, again, out of a science fiction movie. Lower Manhattan was underwater, for God's sake. And since that time, nothing's been done to mitigate it happening again. We're looking at the climate science. It's now believed by climate scientists that we're entering a world where Lower Manhattan's going to go underwater every 5 years. You know, that's going to happen. Well, at some point, Lower Manhattan's just going to be abandoned. No one's going to be able to even, you know, do that anymore and live there or want to. It won't work. And it's just very strange times, you know. I don't think everything's just going to suddenly end one day. I don't think it's that black and white. But we are going to witness, and you guys even more than me because you're younger, but we are going to be witnessing some very bizarre, bizarre things happening in how our lives operate in the coming years. I mean, I'm mortified. This thing that just happened in Paris, you know, you're just watching it already. The reaction to it is going to be horrific. They're going to use it as an excuse. It's going to ramp up the anti-immigration sentiment, racism to any brown-skinned people in France. And it's also going to ramp up, you know, indiscriminate bombings of any place we would like. Our so-called intelligence claims there's something to do with ISIS. I mean, the whole thing is, it's just going to play itself out in an escalating nightmare. And the more we do that, the more it politicizes people who are going to want to commit acts of terrorism against us because they have no, you know, asymmetrical warfare. It's just, again, what I mentioned it briefly, but what we did, you know, we were like a bulldog stuck in a cage, poked with a stick on September 11, 2001, and we reacted in exactly the way Osama bin Laden hoped we would, the stupidest way possible. You know, we destroyed our economy. We've spent trillions of dollars fighting a war we cannot win, and we've stirred up by doing it. You know, ISIS exists. ISIS is the Frankenstein. You probably already know this, but ISIS would not fucking exist if we hadn't invaded Iraq. We uncorked the whole thing by doing that. So, but we're now in an escalating, spiraling upward, violence begets violence, you know, that I'm seeing it ratchet up to where there's no, I don't see any way out of it. It's nasty.
Nasty. I want so badly, so badly to continue this conversation. I mean that since this has been such a pleasure, better far exceeded my expectations. As you could tell, the way the conversation just shifted from, all right, we're going to try and do a structured sort of interview to like, let's just talk. And this has been such a pleasure.
Anyway, I'm sorry. You got to go.
Unfortunately, I really, really got to run. But if you were ever be interested in speaking again, we would love to have you back in any way, shape, or form, and continue this conversation. This is a real, real pleasure.
Yeah, neat. No, thank you. It was fun too. And I got to go. I'm going to go see Don Preston, who played with Frank Zappa in all of his best albums in the 60s and 70s, is playing in Asheville.
Shit.
Yeah, very interesting. And apparently someone told me he knows about our work, which is real exciting to find out about. So that was kind of cool. So I'm going to get to meet him.
Well, excellent. I hope so. I hope you have a great time. I'll be in touch. I actually have an idea I want to throw your way some point soon. So.
Okay.
All right. Be well, guys. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this broadcast from Sync Book Radio. If you enjoyed this episode, there's so much more content waiting for you at thesyncbook.com. Tune into our other Sync Book Radio programs, including 42 Minutes, Always Record, The Marty Leeds Mathematical Radio Hour, Pentimental, Synchronize, Sync Quick News, as well as our most recent editions, Find Us Fine and Hypnosis. Our newest episodes are always free, and members get access to our full archive of over 600 hours. To find all of this, as well as our books and videos at thesyncbook.com.
I know.
You either have no ability to use this for any purpose whatsoever, either for free or for money. You want to test me in the courts? If we did not buy ownership, we bought exclusivity. And if you want to try and check me out, and you go ahead and try and do something with it, and I'm going to sue your ass. You can never use it without our permission.
Maybe he's right.
So I sent you the check. I own it or I control it. You can never use it for anything without my permission. And if you want to challenge me, we'll go to court tomorrow and I'll prove you wrong. And you want to find out? Let's go.
Maybe he's right.
I'm telling you the facts of law and the facts of reality here. The reality is I gave you money, I own it or I control it. If you want to try and do something with it, I'm going to sue you. You never use it for any purpose again or I will sue you.
Maybe he's right.
I own the copyright.
Get a fucking lawyer. Go get a lawyer right now. Let's have it out. I am not going to piss around with you about this. You can't use it without my permission for anything forever. Got it? Get a lawyer, because you're going to need one.
Maybe he's right. Maybe there is something the matter with me.
I'm going to sue your ass.
I just don't see how a world that makes such wonderful things could be bad. Look at this stuff.
I own it.
Isn't it neat? Wouldn't you think my collection's complete?
Find out.
Wouldn't you think I'm the girl?
Let's go.
The girl who has everything.
You can never use it without our permission.
Look at this trove.
I own it.
Treasures untold. How many wonders can one cavern hold?
I'm telling you.
Looking around here, you think.
I own it.
Sure.
Or I control it.
She's got everything.
You can't.
I've got gadgets and gizmos aplenty.
And you want to challenge me?
I've got who's its and what's its galore.
I'm gonna see your ass.
You want thingamabobs?
Get a fucking lawyer.
I got 20. But who cares? No big deal. I want more.
I'm gonna be copied.
Go get a lawyer
right now. Let's
talk
about it.
Gimme, gimme, gimme.
I'm not gonna.
I need some more. Gimme, gimme, gimme. Don't ask what for.
Piss around with you about this.
Gimme, gimme, gimme.
For anything.
I need some more.
Forever.
Gimme, gimme, gimme.
For anything.
Don't ask what for.
Forever.
Gimme, gimme, gimme. Gimme, gimme, gimme!
Forever.
Don't ask what for!
Forever.
Gimme, gimme, gimme!
For anything.
I need some more!
Forever.
Gimme, gimme, gimme!
Forever.
Don't ask what for!
Got it.
Gimme, gimme, gimme!
For anything.
I need some more!
Forever.
Gimme, gimme, gimme!
For
exactly modernism and all this international law to make profit out of his own ungenerosity to humankind.